Bad news for two of Cincinnati's biggest companies. Kroger will be cutting hundreds of jobs, and GE Aerospace has hundreds of employees on strike. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll discuss the cuts and the strike. We'll also talk about the many candidates running for Cincinnati City Council and what the large field could mean for City Hall. And another institutional landlord is facing lawsuits in Hamilton County. Joining me in this recorded interview to get us started are Cincinnati Business Courier Managing Editor Andy Brownfield and staff reporter Brian Planalp. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks, Lucy. Thanks for having us.
As we mentioned, these two big employers have some big news this week. We've got the job cuts at Kroger and a worker strike at GE Aerospace. Andy, how significant is it for Cincinnati that these companies are facing these challenges?
These are two of our biggest public companies, and by that very factor, two of the biggest companies in our city. But Cincinnati has a very large and diverse business base. However, it is unfortunate, especially with the highly skilled and highly paid nature of some of these jobs, especially when it comes to Kroger, a lot of the people who are laid off, that's a pretty sizable chunk of our professional workforce that's now out of work. And, you know, it's not just happening in a vacuum. At the same time, Procter & Gamble is also undergoing a large restructuring, which, Lucy, we've talked about before on this program, where they're cutting about 7,000 non-manufacturing jobs, or 15% of its total non-manufacturing workforce over the next several years.
Wow. How many local Kroger workers are we talking about? How many could lose their jobs? And tell us more about what type of jobs these are.
So company-wide, Kroger is cutting about 1,000 positions, and locally that is about 200 is what we've been told. Now, these aren't in-store positions, these are all corporate positions, and it's happening across the entire Kroger structure. So Kroger Corporate, Kroger Digital, and most of these are administrative positions. These are, you know, corporate professionals.
Brian, when it comes to GE Aerospace, how many workers are on strike there?
There are 640 workers on strike right now. It's a small slice of GE Aerospace's workforce in the region, which numbers around 9,000 and is its largest concentration of workers worldwide. Obviously, GE has its headquarters in Evendale. But you can tell it's important to GE, these workers, because the company has activated a contingency plan to backfill the roles during the strike rather than letting them go vacant.
Ah, okay. So they've got backup people to do the jobs of the striking workers. Well, let's dive in more on Kroger before we get back to GE. Andy, what reason did the interim CEO at Kroger give for these cuts?
So Ron Sargent, who took over for Rodney McMullen after he left due to unspecified violation of Kroger's business ethics code. Ron's the former CEO of Staples. He wrote a memo to Kroger staff saying that in the past few months, he's been looking at ways to simplify the organization, shift resources closer to customers, and focus on work that creates the most value. So that's pretty vague. It wasn't really specified what exactly led to this, other than, you know, typical corporates were shifting priorities, projects that were not directly helping us to run great stores, those are being cuts. So all of that has kind of led to these cuts. He described them as a meaningful number of associate reductions and that the decision wasn't easy, but they're necessary to set up Kroger, he said, for continued success.
Andy, what will these cuts mean for customers? Will there be an impact?
So this is where it's interesting. Ron Sargent said that the savings from these staff reductions are going to be reinvested directly into stores. And what that's going to look like, according to Sargent, is price reductions, is adding hours to store teams to have more staffing in their stores and more associates available to customers for when they need them. But then on top of that, the savings are going to be reinvested to building up Kroger's real estate capabilities. So that kind of hints at the strategy going forward. Kroger is already the nation's largest operator of traditional supermarkets, and it has been announcing new store openings. So it looks like Ron intends to accelerate or at least continue that strategy.
Well, Andy, this isn't the first round of job cuts at Kroger this year, is it?
No, it's not. This is the first time, though, that we've gotten a good idea of the scope of the cuts. So this is, I believe, the second round of cuts that Kroger has embarked on this year. The first one was announced in February. It was, you know, we were told that Kroger had cut an unspecified amount of jobs, but hundreds. It was described as hundreds of jobs, and it was described as an effort towards efficiency. And those jobs were cut in the Cincinnati market. So this most recent round of cuts was across Kroger's national footprint. But the February cuts were in three local sites. It's 8451 Data Compilation and Analysis Unit. It's Kroger Technology and Digital Team in Blue Ash, and downtown in the Atrium 2 building. Now, the second round of cuts was announced in March, and this time we didn't get any idea of how many positions were eliminated, just that a, quote, small number of roles were cut at that time. That Kroger both times really declined to elucidate on the nature or reasons for those cuts, but it appears that this most recent round is a continuation of that strategy.
Okay, so first round in February, then March, and now this one. Are these job cuts, any of these rounds, this current one, any of the ones before, are they related to Kroger's attempt to merge with Albertsons?
Kroger didn't specify on that, but it's hard to imagine that they're not. I mean, Albertsons is pretty similar in size to Kroger. Both of them operate more than 2,000 stores, Kroger closer to 3,000. And the merger would have essentially almost doubled Kroger in size, even after the planned divestitures. When you're planning to absorb that kind of scale, it's hard to imagine that Kroger wouldn't have staffed up to make that happen. And then when the merger was called off after two different judges in December ruled against Kroger on antitrust grounds, I think that excess capacity was probably no longer needed.
Andy, do you know how many local employees Kroger will have after this?
So I'm not entirely sure. They have not given us an updated headcount, but as of February, when we reported on the first round of layoffs, you know, we had been told the prior year that Kroger had about 5,800 employees in Greater Cincinnati who work at its headquarters downtown, 8451, its technology and digital groups. I'd still imagine that Kroger has about in the mid 5,000 employees in Greater Cincinnati, that even after these cuts.
Well, let's move to GE Aerospace. For that company, Brian, tell us when the strike started. Was there a vote of the union members that kind of launched the strike?
The strike started at 12:01 a.m. Thursday morning. The union's local bargaining unit voted on GE offers in the days leading up to this strike. But the UAW did not allow the local to vote on GE's latest offer. But the president of the local has voiced support for the strike.
What kind of work do the striking workers do at GE Aerospace?
Yeah, they're spread across two facilities, one in Evendale and one in Erlanger near CVG. The Erlanger workers distribute GE parts to the airport, and those parts then go to GE plants worldwide. Some of them actually like in the belly of passenger aircraft. The Evendale workers assemble marine and industrial engines for the U.S. Navy.
And you mentioned the UAW, that's the union, I guess, that represents these workers?
Yeah, it's the International Union of United Automobile, Aerospace, and Agricultural Implement Workers of America, which is obviously more commonly known as UAW.
Yeah, I can understand why they go by UAW.
Right.
What can you tell us about the negotiations? What is the company offering, and what does the union seem to want?
In terms of pay, GE's latest offer included a 12% pay bump over the three-year terms of the deal, and cost of living adjustments tied to inflation, which was a big thing. Also offered accelerated cash payments. So a worker would get about $2,500 just up front. And it also offered a guarantee to keep at least 620 of the local's current employees at sites. And then it also offered a promise to create 80 more jobs at the two facilities. And then kind of assorted, you know, things like more paid time off. The UAW took issue with that headcount guarantee. They said GE is trying to tie job security guarantees to productivity metrics that they control, which I don't know, sounds like just being employed to me, but I don't know. But the UAW's primary concern is healthcare. The union claims GE wants to substantially increase healthcare costs for employees. And the company has acknowledged that costs are going to go up. The union claims 40% over the 3 years. GE says it's closer to 18%. But GE has defended the increase by saying that employee healthcare costs have essentially been frozen for the last 3 years. And the company estimates an employee represented by the UAW that makes a median wage would pay an additional $2,300 for a full family healthcare plan over the life of the contract, 3 years. But average wages for that person would go up $29,000.
I see. Has GE Aerospace been able to make deals with any of the other unions that represent its employees? I mean, the UAW isn't the only union there, right?
Yeah. It's reached deals with two other unions in the past several months, one of which represents employees not in Cincinnati, and then one of which that represents about 540 employees in Evendale. And the negotiations for that, those negotiations began the same day the negotiations with the UAW began, and they progressed pretty well. And they signed a deal on August 3rd. But sort of in the media releases that were chronicling the negotiations GE was putting out, the language used to describe the other union's negotiations were, you know, promising and moving swiftly. And the language used to describe the UAW was sort of slow and plodding. And I doubt they were making much progress.
Do you have any idea how long a strike like this could last? I mean, you said it started a little after like 12:01, just after midnight on Thursday morning. So it hasn't been that long. Any idea how long it could last?
Yeah, it's not totally clear. The sides seem pretty entrenched and the UAW isn't backing off its rhetoric. It is repeatedly called GE's offers insulting. But with GE backfilling the roles, as I mentioned before, they don't seem to have a lot of bargaining power. Or leverage the union. So that's one thing. Another thing to note is that, you know, when employees strike, their benefits usually stop, including pay. But GE is right now opting to continue benefits for the UAW employees, kind of recognizing the importance of, you know, continuing to cover the workers and their families, which is maybe an indication that I don't think GE expects this to last that long.
Okay, well, I have been talking with Cincinnati Business Courier Managing Editor Andy Brownfield and Staff Reporter Brian Plenalp. Thank you both so much for your time today. Up next, we'll discuss the crowded field in this fall's Cincinnati City Council race. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Voters will have lots of options when it comes time to elect Cincinnati City Council members in November. Joining me in this recorded interview to discuss the field and the issues that could define council campaigns is Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Welcome back, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Well, thanks for being here. How many candidates for City Council will be on the ballot this year?
We just checked in with that earlier this week. There will be 26 candidates, which is the most since the 2021 election. And we all remember, of course, that the 21 election brought a bumper crop of candidates because of the scandal down at City Hall with three council members being indicted on federal corruption charges. So we are kind of a little bit more normalish in terms of the number of candidates that we have. Compared to, you know, other years.
Okay, so a whole lot, but not a record by a long shot.
Now, I don't know what the all-time record was, but in 21, there were 35, I believe, that year. And that was considered a lot.
Yeah. So will all the current members of council, minus Victoria Parks, who is not running, will they all, except her, be on the ballot?
That is correct, yes. And then, so they are all eight of those candidates who are already on council are Democrats. There is a ninth Democrat named Ryan James. He's a nonprofit executive with United Way. He is also endorsed by the Cincinnati Democrats for council.
Who are some of the other well-known names who will be on the ballot? There are several former city council members, aren't there?
There are four former city council members who have served that will be on the ballot. Probably the most well-known is former Vice Mayor Christopher Smitherman, who at this point is running as an independent. He's not endorsed by the Charter Committee or the Republican Party. The Republicans are expected to endorse a slate sometime, I believe in September. Another prominent person who's pretty well known is former Councilwoman Liz Keating, who has traditionally run as both a Republican and a Charterite. What's interesting about Keating is, we'll see whether she goes for that Republican endorsement this year. She's obviously a lifetime Republican. But the Charter Committee has kind of said, well, we're not going to do cross endorsements. And so she may have to choose one or the other, or maybe she'll choose none at all. We don't know yet.
So Charter isn't going to do cross endorsements. They've done cross endorsements in the past, haven't they?
Very much so. And they've kind of depended on them in a large part to get members on council. But Charter Committee convener Steve Gooden — convener is the Charter Committee word for leader or chair or however you want to look at it — he told me earlier this month that they are not planning to do that this time. So I think they want to kind of stand on their own record and kind of run as a, run as a group of people who have similar beliefs on how City Hall and City Council should work. Going through the names again, of course, we just mentioned Steve Gooden, also a former council member. He served in 2021. He was appointed to replace Councilman Jeff Pastor. He was not able to be elected to the seat to a full term in 21 when he ran. And the last former council member is Lakeeta Cole, who was, kind of served in the 2000s and maybe a little bit of the 2010s, not very much. But she was also, she was there during the growth of the city in that era. And so she's also running with the Charter Committee endorsement.
When she served on council previously, did Lakeeta Cole serve as a Democrat?
She did, yes. Yeah, she was a Democrat.
Okay. Well, that's just some of the names. You mentioned there are 9 endorsed by the Democrats. I think you just talked about 4 others. There's still lots of other candidates that we could talk about. But first, I want to get into this. You call this election possibly a wake-up call for City Hall. Why is that?
We've had a lot of, obviously, news that has made national news about, the uptick in crime in downtown and over the Rhine. It's made national news because of the infamous 4th Street brawl. But if you talk to the Charter Committee folks, they are more focused on the uptick in crime that has kind of happened in the neighborhoods, West End, downtown, OTR, some other neighborhoods. The crime that actually affects people, not crime based on an alcohol-fueled bar brawl. And so they believe they have a foothold on the election. They believe that they have a good chance because of that issue. But also, I think they're also looking at development issues. And the Hyde Park Square development is one that I hear them talking about. And just the Connected Communities zoning reform proposal that passed council last year. And so I think those are kind of the two major things that they are talking about. And they're basically pitching themselves as, we are a group of candidates that are going to listen to people and to, be more cognizant of what residents want and need in their neighborhoods. That's their overriding message at this point. We've been told that they will have some kind of platform, and that's where things will get interesting. That's where you get to probe that overarching message a little bit more to see what they say about specific things.
Well, and of course, the Charter Committee, these other candidates who are running as independents or haven't sought endorsements yet, the idea is to shake up council because it's held — all the council seats are held by Democrats now. How long have Democrats held all those seats on city council?
Not for very long. They've really just held them over the last, this term that we're currently in, which is a 2-year term. In the term that started when Mayor Aftab Pureval was elected in 2021, that term began 2022. We had 8 members of council that were Democrats. So this is a long-term trend that has been kind of coming, where Democrats have a bigger and really super-sized majority on city council. This is very common in other large cities in Ohio, but it has not been true in Cincinnati for most of the last 50 years. And so this is a kind of a late, you know, the old Mark Twain saying comes to mind that we're kind of late to everything, and we're late to that as well, I think. Huh. City Hall traditionally has been a tripartisan body, government of body, and there have been Republicans, Democrats, and Charterites. Now, Democrats have usually had the most seats numerically, but often what would happen was Charterites and Democrats would team up, or there would be some Democrats who team up with Republicans, and they would kind of have an operating majority. And that was true as recently as Mayor John Cranley's administration.
Do you think the mayor's race will be competitive at all this year with all the concern over crime? I mean, the FOP had this recent vote of no confidence in the mayor. There's, as you mentioned, this vocal opposition to the Hyde Park Square redevelopment. Do you think those will be factors in the mayor's race?
I don't think our mayor's race is going to be very competitive. You know, Corey Bowman is he's a nice guy. He's, you know, made an issue out of the crime problems and other issues. He talks a lot about the budget, but I think people know by now that he is the vice president's brother, and Republicans and Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, they are not popular in the city of Cincinnati, and it is going to be a very rough sledding for him. We saw during the primary that the mayor got more than 80% of the vote against two people running against him who were Republicans. And I don't expect, you know, him to be very competitive in the general election.
Will the railroad sale be a factor? I mean, there was vocal opposition to that too. And you reported that the city hasn't really started to see the fruits of that sale yet.
I think people are going to talk about it. I think they're going to say, where is this money? And, you know, the budget just passed with the first amount of railroad money. The budget just passed in July, in late June. And the new fiscal year began in July. So we've had about 2 months to see any results. That's not a long time, but I think people are aware that the city has this significant pot of money. And I think they would like to see their streets fixed and various other things that have vexed the city in terms of its basic services and basic infrastructure. So I think in that respect, they will talk about it. I don't know that you're going to see a message out there, oh, we shouldn't have sold the railroad. I think the message is going to be more, you know, where is that money and why isn't it helping my neighborhood? Now, at the same time, if City Hall can get that ramped up, It's a long tradition in politics for mayors and city council members to go, and members of Congress and state legislators to go and cut ribbons as projects start. And I wouldn't be surprised to see some of that happening as well.
You mentioned that Cincinnati, the political composition of Cincinnati City Council has been changing over the years. What are the long-term political implications of this council race?
I'm going to be really focused on where we go on development, right? We have this big fight in Hyde Park over this development. And, you know, one of the questions for the Charter Committee, I think, and their candidates is, are they basically saying they want neighborhoods to have veto power over what developers do in neighborhoods? And so, you know, for the Business Courier, for our readers, that's one of the biggest things is what kind of effect will that have on development, and what kind of effect will that have on the city's growth? So, you know, we definitely want to understand better what the Charter Committee, you know, has planned and how that would change if they, you know, gain two or three or four seats or something like that, the governing coalition and the calculation on council will change, as you know, especially regarding those issues. And so that's, you know, it's something we're going to be very curious about and talking to them about as the campaign goes on.
Well, let's talk more about development. You know, we've mentioned several times there's this vocal opposition to the Hyde Park Square redevelopment. Two city council members tried to negotiate a compromise earlier this week. Tell us who was involved with all that and whether they made any progress.
Right. Well, they didn't make any progress, or it doesn't sound like they did, there, at least in terms of signing a final deal. What happened was one member who voted against the project, Scotty Johnson, and another member who was supportive of it, Seth Walsh, they convened the two sides, the developers, and then, you know, members of the Hyde Park community to try to sit down at City Hall and hammer something out. And really, they continue to be at an impasse. The major issue is the height of the buildings. And the Hyde Park coalition of groups that are against the project as it is currently conceived, they don't want it to be any higher than about 62, 63 feet, which is the height of the Elace building, which is kind of next door to the development and which the developer will also redevelop. The developer has conceded that, you know, most of the buildings will be at 62 or 63 feet, but they want a stepped back story, additional story on one of the buildings that would front Erie Avenue. And so the total height of the development would be, you know, of that part of the development would be about 75 feet. The, you know, the plan continues to be from the developer to, you know, if you think of a wedding cake, how each layer, there'll be a one step back layer. And so if you're standing on the street on Erie Avenue and you look up at this building, you will not be able to see more than the first five stories. Now, if you're, you know, 100 yards away and you have a view of it, yes, you're going to see the, you know, you're going to see the additional story. And so that is kind of the main point of contention in which they cannot agree on. And that's where that stands as of today. The clock is ticking. Next week, the council either has to repeal that development or put it on the ballot. And so the clock is ticking and we'll see what happens.
And you said the clock's ticking. What's that deadline? Is it September 4th? Am I remembering that correctly?
That's right. So council will meet next week on the 4th because of the holiday. That's a Thursday. So we did get a release actually this morning. We're taping this on Thursday, of course, talking about the 29th as a potential deadline to actually have something in writing. So stay tuned on that, I guess. But, you know, the actual like drop dead deadline for the city council to act is September 4th.
And who are the council members who brought these sides together to try to negotiate a compromise?
Right. It was Scotty Johnson and Seth Walsh. Seth Walsh had voted for it, and Scotty Johnson had voted against it.
Does the Save Hyde Park Square group, this is the group that's been very vocal in opposing this development, do they think a compromise can be reached at this point?
I'm not sure. I mean, everyone is in a, we hope we can do it type of a mode. No one is saying they're walking away from the table or anything like that.
Okay. Well, we will stay tuned. I've been talking with Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thanks so much for your time today, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Up next, another institutional landlord faces lawsuits in Cincinnati. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Another big landlord is being sued in Cincinnati, and a former fire chief is moving forward with his wrongful termination lawsuit against the city. Joining me now to explain all this is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and general assignment reporter Nick Sportzel. Welcome back, Nick and Becca. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
Becca, I mentioned another big landlord is being sued. Let's start with that. Tell us about this company, Second Avenue. How big is it and what kinds of homes does it rent out locally?
Yeah, so Second Avenue is a national investment company. It's been around for a little while, but just started purchasing single family homes in Cincinnati about 3 years ago. So they rent single family homes in about 24 cities across the country, including some pretty major markets like Atlanta, Chicago, Dallas, Miami. There are some also in the Midwest here closer to us, like Indianapolis and Louisville. And like I said, they deal primarily in single family homes. Right now, they own more than 200 properties in Hamilton County. The exact number is a little difficult to calculate, and it seems to shift a little bit. That's for a couple reasons. One, they own at least 16 LLCs here in Hamilton County, not all of them properly registered with the state of Ohio. But they will sometimes change ownership of the properties between the LLCs. There are also likely some LLCs that we don't know about. But then also they're kind of purchasing and selling single family properties occasionally.
Oh, wow. Very complicated. When was this class action lawsuit filed and what does it allege, Becca?
So it was filed August 21st. There's kind of a mixed bag of issues here. A lot has to deal with maintenance. So there are allegations that tenants have faced long periods of time without proper maintenance repairs for pretty serious things like raw sewage backups in the basement, things like no electric during like extreme weather, so like extreme cold or extreme heat, so no heat or air conditioning for weeks at a time, no working refrigerator, no working hot water for long periods of time. And these are things that are alleged of the four tenants who are in the lawsuit, but that my colleague Nick kind of confirmed, or not confirmed, but heard from other tenants, other places as well. There are also allegations about what they're calling illegal conditions in their lease agreements.
What are those illegal conditions?
Yeah, so a few of them are, so things like they say that tenants have to handle pest control at their own expense. That is contrary to state law. Most of this in the Landlord-Tenant Act. That tenants are responsible for maintenance repairs that cost less than $200. Second Avenue frequently charges fees between $50 and $75 for some maintenance visits to the property. So if they are required to come to the property after business hours, for example, or for multiple times, if they feel the tenant should have taken care of the issue, they could charge up to $75 just to come visit the property. They charge a 10% a late fee. So if your rent is late, 10% of your rent is the late fee. That is a city municipal code violation, according to the lawsuit. The city does say that late fees can be no more than $50 or 5% of the rent. They also charge move-out fees that go beyond what state law allows. So state law specifies that move-out fees can be damages that the landlord has suffered. So Second Avenue is in some cases charging fees for things like landscaping, that kind of thing. And so the lawsuit is saying that does not fit within what's allowed in state law for move-out fees. One big one is in the lease agreements that are included in the lawsuit, Second Avenue requires the tenants to give up some of their legal rights that are in state law. So specifically, Second Avenue is saying we can evict you without legal notice if you don't pay your rent. That is not according to state law.
Wow. Nick, Becca just mentioned that there are four tenants who are part of that lawsuit. What do we know about them? Are they still living in these properties?
So two are not still living in the properties. They are experiencing homelessness, according to the filings. And I know at least one of the tenants who is in the lawsuit is still living in the Second Avenue property. The fourth one, Becca, they also still in the property?
Also still on the property. That's right. Correct.
Yeah, yeah.
And Nick, you mentioned experiencing homelessness. Why is that? Were the conditions so bad that they had to leave, or?
In one of the cases, that is the allegation. In the other one, it's a little more indirect, I think, but related to the conditions. Is that right, Becca?
Related to the conditions, and the other one also related to the late fees that I mentioned. Wow. And the sort of what they're saying are illegal fees. So it is a result of an eviction that was filed in part because of these late fees that a tenant was paying for a very, very long time, consistently paying late fees that the lawsuit says are illegal. And then there was also there's an issue that many tenants have reported where the app that they're supposed to be able to pay their rent on monthly will sometimes be suddenly unavailable. And then it costs a lot of extra money to create a money order and mail that to a property in Florida is often where Second Avenue will ask tenants to send that information. And it gets there late because they weren't planning to send a money order. They were planning to pay on the app. And so it's kind of a snowball effect. And so yeah, that was the effect of one of the folks experiencing homelessness now.
Becca, there's also a public nuisance lawsuit against Second Avenue. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is something that we have seen more often in Cincinnati. So we've seen Cincinnati file lawsuits like this against another. Another big one was Vinebrook Homes, which is another single family property investor. And so the idea of this being a public nuisance, and the city solicitor in this lawsuit says that Second Avenue has this investment practice of acquiring distressed properties that are not in good condition, failing to bring them into good condition or maintain them in good condition, and then renting them out. There are issues with code violations, according to the lawsuit. They say that Second Avenue owes the city about $137,000 in past due civil fines. Those are related to building code violations and health code violations, plus about $2,200 to Greater Cincinnati Water Works for unpaid bills for those properties. So the city is saying this is an issue for the city, not on behalf of the tenants, because the city cannot sue on behalf of tenants. They can sue only to the damages that they say are done to the city itself. And those include the unpaid issues, also the cost to send out inspectors multiple times, the cost to abate certain properties. So if a property is in a dangerous condition and the city can't get the property owner to take care of that, then the city then steps in and pays for putting up a fence or boarding up windows of a vacant home or that kind of thing. And then also that the poor condition of these properties affect the property values of the neighboring properties and of the neighborhood as a whole.
So what are the lawsuits seeking? The public nuisance lawsuits, are they saying, hey, you need to pay us what you owe us?
Yeah, so it's kind of funny, and I'm not a lawyer, but these lawsuits always say, can you please tell the company to start following the law, which seems like kind of an unnecessary step, but that's a common thing in these. And so both lawsuits are saying, you know, asking for a judge, they're different cases, at least right now, but asking for a judge to order Second Avenue to not enforce the lease terms, for example, that they say are illegal. In the public nuisance lawsuit, saying, you know, make them pay what they owe us and stop violating building code and health code, et cetera. The city is also asking for a receiver. This is something I think we've talked about in Cincinnati Edition before, which is basically the idea that a third party could be appointed by the court to take over maintenance of those properties. It's not an ownership thing necessarily, but it's a way to say, you know, we have established, or they say we've established, that Second Avenue is not taking proper care of these properties and is either not capable or not willing to do so. So if a judge agrees with that, they can say, okay, here's someone else that can come in and maintain those properties at least in the short term.
Nick, Becca just mentioned the Vinebrook lawsuit. You've been covering Vision and Beyond, which is another property owner that where there are legal actions being taken. How do these kinds of lawsuits affect broader communities? I mean, what is the impact that these properties have in addition to how they're affecting the tenants who live there?
Sure. There's also the Williamsburg lawsuit as well. I think the theory here is that you're sending a message as the city that, hey, we're gonna really clamp down on you if you keep your buildings in poor condition, if you do things that are illegal to your tenants. So I think the broader impact is supposed to be at least that landlords follow the law, keep their property in good condition, and provide livable conditions for tenants.
Yeah. Well, I want to know more about these conditions and these Second Avenue rental homes. You, Nick, talked to roughly a dozen renters who are not part of this lawsuit. Here's Earl Hollis and Alyssa McDonald.
No heat, February, when it was cold. We had, space heaters.
They've always said that all the repairs were my responsibility.
Nick, did you go inside some of these homes and see some of these conditions that people told you about?
Yeah, I did. I fanned out across several neighborhoods and knocked on doors of properties that were owned by Second Avenue. And several people did let me inside their homes and kind of showed me some of the things. In Earl's case, he had several issues that he was really concerned about, including there was a lot of flooding in his basement that he kept having. There were some beams that kind of like supported his first floor, the joists, and they were kind of chewed into or not complete. There were some issues with his HVAC system where a lot of venting was missing, where he showed me places where, and that, in addition to some other things he was really concerned about. With Alyssa, there was a little bit of a difference in terms of kind of what her issues were. She did have a significant leak that hadn't been fully repaired. She said a lot of the stuff with her was more on the lease terms end and the way the company handled an eviction with her.
Hmm. Which neighborhoods did you visit? You mentioned you visited several.
I went to properties in Evanston, Avondale, North Fairmount, Price Hill, Spring Grove Village, and a couple others.
Wow. So they do have properties all over the place. Is it normal, Nick, for a rental company to require tenants to pay for repairs?
Not for maintenance that occurs due to wear and tear on the house that is, you know, to be expected. Now, if you, you know, go full rock star and throw a chair through a window, you know, that kind of thing you might be on the hook for eventually. But for the kinds of things we were seeing, sewage backups in the basement, trees falling in the backyard, roof damage that was, you know, due to wear and tear. These are things that tenants are claiming they were told by Second Avenue were their responsibility. Those are not your responsibility under the law generally.
Hmm. Becca, let me ask you this first, Nick. Have any of these renters you interviewed gotten the city involved to try to address these problems? I wonder what city code compliance records show.
Yeah, so in the cases of the people I visited, the code compliance issues at their properties or at their rental houses were pre-existing before they moved in. The code record that you can see online on the city shows that there were multiple code complaints. Those weren't all cleared up when the residents moved in. And so in one case, a person was living in a house. He says a code inspector came by and was surprised he was living there because the house was not supposed to be occupied. And then when you look at the records, you can see there were numerous issues. And the company did address some and has not addressed others. There are still open code complaints on that particular property, and there's a person living there.
If I just one quick anecdote that it really surprised me when I was looking through some of these code compliance issues. So looking at a particular address, there you can see the inspection notes from the folks who are going out there, and they go out every couple of months while things are not being done. And there's one note that says, you know, there had been some code compliance issues, building code violations. And then the inspector notes that they called who they thought the property owner was, and that was Vinebrook. And then Vinebrook said, no, we sold that. And they had sold it to Second Avenue. And there are still open code violations on that property today.
Wow. Becca, have you gotten any response from Second Avenue, or has the company filed any kind of response in court yet related to all this?
No to either of those. So as of this morning, as of just now, Second Avenue does not have an attorney in this either of these lawsuits filed with the court, so not listed online. So there's not a local attorney that we can reach out to. There are a few ways that we did try to get in touch with Second Avenue before publishing. One is a kind of general media contact on the Second Avenue website. Again, this is a national company. They don't have a local office that we can go knock on their door. There's also a local attorney who handles the eviction cases for Second Avenue, and Nick reached out to that attorney, and we did not hear back.
Just briefly, Becca, what's the status of this case now? Are there any hearings scheduled?
So in the class action lawsuit case, actually on the day it was filed, there was a hearing because they had asked for a temporary restraining order, an injunction to keep Second Avenue from enforcing these illegal lease terms against only the four plaintiffs that are named so far. That was granted. It was a two-week injunction. So that expires on September 4th, and there is a hearing scheduled for that on that date, ostensibly to ask for an extension of that. I'm not sure if anything else will happen at that hearing. In the city's lawsuit, it was just filed Tuesday, I'm blanking now, earlier this week, and nothing has been scheduled in that case yet.
Okay. Well, Becca, we've been talking about this lawsuit the city filed and this class action lawsuit. Now let's talk about the wrongful termination lawsuit a former Cincinnati fire chief filed against the city. Remind us why city manager Cheryl Long says she fired former chief Michael Washington.
Yeah, so this dates back to March 2023. It was about 6 months after City Manager Cheryl Long had taken the job full time. And she made kind of a public announcement. There was a press release. She gave interviews to media at that time to say that she had fired Chief Michael Washington. Kind of the main reason that she cited was this unhealthy, what she called an unhealthy workplace culture toward women. This was kind of a known issue before even this fire chief took that position, and certainly before Cheryl Long took this position as city manager. Long says that when she kind of took over as city manager, she had worked with Michael Washington and said, this is an issue you need to address. And she said she feels he did not address that adequately. She had asked for a specific report that she says was never done. There were other issues that she cited as contributing to her decision, including the way he handled a disciplinary case with a fire officer, and also some a little bit more generic, but some communication issues between him and her office, and then also how he was handling the need for a new fire training tower. Interestingly, that they cut the ribbon on that yesterday. Nick covered that story. But at the time, it had not been finalized yet, and it had taken a really long time to get to that point. And so Cheryl Long said, that's one of the reasons that she felt he could no longer be in charge.
Well, and Michael Washington filed suit shortly after he was filed. What does his lawsuit allege?
That's right. So he said a couple of things. So it's wrongful termination, and he said that the city violated his due process, that he was entitled to a pre-termination hearing before he was fired, and he did not get that. He also said that according to the charter, he could only be fired for cause. Now, Cheryl Long did give her reasons that she said were the cause for that decision, but he said that those things were not true or misrepresented, and that they did not warrant enough to justify firing for cause. He also said that because Cheryl Long spoke so publicly about these things and gave her reasons publicly, and that he says those reasons are not true, he's saying that that amounts to defamation of his character, and that delayed how long he took to get another job, and hurt his reputation and his character.
So what did a judge decide in the case this week?
So this week, a judge decided a couple of things. The city had asked for summary judgment. So the case is going to trial, a jury trial, but the city had said, let a judge just decide. The judge did a couple of small decisions, including, you know, giving Cheryl Long or acknowledging that Cheryl Long has immunity for some of these allegations related to timing. A little bit complicated to explain. But the judge did say that a reasonable jury could determine either that Long's statements were defamatory or not. And so those are things that, you know, will be considered in a jury. But so one key thing was that the judge did decide that Michael Washington's right to due process was indeed violated by the city. And specifically by Cheryl Long, because they were not did not offer this pre-termination hearing, which is, according to the judge's interpretation, a requirement of the city charter.
What's the lawsuit seeking? Is there a specific dollar amount that Michael Washington is seeking in all this?
There's not a dollar amount listed, but he's asking for damages, including back pay, front pay, health insurance benefits, other employee benefits. He was a part of the Ohio Police and Fire Pension Fund, so asking for whatever contribution the city would have made in the time since he was fired, that be there. Attorney's fees, also compensatory and punitive damages. All of that would be determined at trial, you know, whether he is entitled to damages, depending on what a jury decides on these different counts. And then if they decide that he is, how much that would be.
And how has the city responded to the judge's decision this week?
We do not comment on pending litigation, which is a common thing we hear often. But we did reach out for comment and they declined to comment.
Okay. When is this scheduled to go to trial?
The trial is set to begin September 29th. Now, it would not surprise me if that got delayed. There has been, you know, a lot of work on this first filed in 2023, but a lot of activity just in the last couple of months. And so it may be a little while longer before they're ready for trial.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and general assignment reporter Nick Swartzel. Thank you both so much for your time today. Thank you for this important reporting on Second Avenue. I know you both were working really hard on that very important story, and I hope you both get some R&R this weekend.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. And our technical director today is the fabulous Ella Rowan. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.